This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today, we're examining the relationship between money and politics, specifically whether the act of donating money to political candidates or advocacy groups is a basic freedom or a form of free speech. The 2010 Supreme Court Citizens United decision ruled that anonymous political donations by corporations and unions are protected under the First Amendment and cannot be restricted by the government. But critics of this decision argue that the unchecked flow of money into our political system perpetuates social and economic inequality in America, increases unfair political influence, and they argue that financial limits and government regulation is needed to preserve democracy and an equal society. This past year, a number of speakers at the Hinckley Institute of Politics have explored this issue of campaign contributions and its links to economic and political inequality. Our first speaker is Joseph Schwartz, professor of political science at Temple University. He's published numerous articles examining the challenges of egalitarian politics and policy. He spoke during a symposium on money and politics on March 20th, 2013.
I want to argue that the role of money in politics today is more a symptom of the rise and hegemony of a neoliberal market fundamentalism, I'll define that in a second, rather than the primary cause or its interactive. Many of you know the ideology of neoliberalism and that you were brought up with it. Too much of an interventionist state, and as Jeffrey said, a state that taxes the rich and the affluent and corporations too heavily, is going to thwart entrepreneurship, investment, and incentives. And that state provision is, as much as the University of Utah is a state university, is inefficient and the private is better. So I would urge all of you to try to get into private universities and pay Brigham Young's tuition. But in any event, those of us who do teach at state institutions probably don't fully believe this ideology, I would hope. But it's the way to summarize this is, if I was going to give a sort of definition of neoliberalism to the broader public, think about the four D's of neoliberalism. One, the state should deregulate the economy, get out of the business of regulating big business and powerful interests as much as possible. We should decrease taxes on the wealthy and corporations, the second D. It's a good thing to defund the state. In the immortal words of Grover Norquist, let's drown the welfare state in the little water of the declining bathtub, the declining state revenues. And of course, and this is a big problem because, as Hacker and Pearson sort of imply, and we're going to take all possible, deunionize the economy because that's the big countervailing force that historically has limited corporate power. But neoliberalism also says money is speech, that the way to have democratic discourse is for consumers to choose with their dollars. But the idea that consumers can choose with their dollars means if you have more dollars, you have more choice. And Citizens United is a very neoliberal sort of doctrine. It's money is freedom, and speech is money, and money is speech, so we shouldn't restrict it. But anybody who studied democratic capitalism historically, or the history of capitalism, knows that the demos, democracy, has often mobilized, A, to get the suffrage, which, as Jeffrey said, universal suffrage is a very recent thing to be cherished. And remember, we did not have one person, one voice, one vote in this country until 1965. We didn't have women's suffrage until 1920. Whether we should have suffrage for the millions of people who work in this economy but have no voice, undocumented workers, and if they were forced out tomorrow, the upper middle class would have nobody to take care of their elders, their children, clean their homes, whatever. You know, who should have voice? But the demos always used that voice to restrict the power of elites, right? That was their one sort of lever. And if you think about, you know, the great British sociologist T.H. Marshall, once ordinary people get civil and political rights, they usually use it to create social rights. And that is to take out, to use the power of the state and progressive taxation to take out of the market certain basic human needs. One of them is education. The right still is trying to privatize education. They're having some resistance, whatever. But other things were like old age security, old age pensions, right? Other things were some public provision to guard you against the vagaries of the job market. So if you're unemployed, to get some degree of public subsidy when you're unemployed. It was to transfer income from those who were less vulnerable to those who, by the chance of the market or injury or health, ill health, were more vulnerable. And hint, we maybe will become a modern democratic capitalist society if we have affordable universal health care. And that's a big if, because one interesting question is usually oligarchs or corporate interests are split. But why corporate interests who are involved in manufacturing, in retail services, given if they provide health care, the heavy costs, why they didn't align with people who are trying to restrict the power of private health care insurers and private health care providers in the debate about Obamacare? Basically, Obamacare is now a huge subsidy to private pharmaceuticals, to private hospitals, to private health insurers, to the medical instrument industry, and it's not clear it's going to get costs down enough. I mean, I'm still for it if we can implement it, because it'll raise the cost debate and it will at least begin to say that everyone in the United States should be covered. But the interesting question is about sort of corporate power and the ideology of market freedom is that I think it squeezes certain questions out of politics, either by elites mobilizing to get these questions off the agenda or using the power of think tanks, the power of a corporate media to even prevent these questions coming up. For example, you don't hear, even on MSNBC really, that we don't really have a spending problem in this country. We have a revenue shortage problem. Very few Americans know, here's the dirty little secret, the Reagan and Bush tax cuts, Bush the second, each took out of the federal treasury 2.1% each time of the GDP. We can argue about whether they should all be reversed or only for the top 10%, not just the top two. If they were all reversed tomorrow morning, next year, the federal government would have $640 billion more in revenue. There's a conscious effort to defund the state. You all think the state is big. The United States has the most cheap-ass, mean-spirited, means-tested welfare state in the country. We channel 30% of our GDP through not just the federal government, the state government. Britain, the other most neoliberal country, Thatcher, Reagan, 36%. Every other European country is 40 to 50. Why? Because they have universal child care and universal health care. If everyone had child care in this country, universal federally financed child care, there never would have been a welfare debate. Working people, single moms, two-parent couples would have had help with child care. The working class and middle class of all races did not like people, single moms who stayed at home with kids, most of whom took a temporary break from the labor market and then came back into it. 75% of women on welfare had a long history of working in the formal labor market before and after they had infants. They didn't like it because working class people didn't get child care. They had to pay for it if they could out of their meager salaries. Same reason why there's a lot of resistance and among people who don't get decent health care, who make a little more than the Medicaid level, right? You know, why should those people get it? A lot of the right wing's attack on public goods was very racialized and very focused, as it was in Britain, on the means-tested nature of child care, that you can only get child support from the government if you were poor.
That's Joseph Schwartz, professor of political science at Temple University, speaking last year at the Hinckley Institute. In continuing with the subject of social inequality and its relationship to money and influence in politics, Elizabeth Rigby is professor of public policy and public administration at George Washington University. She researches the interplay of politics, policy, and social inequality in America.
So we've had this longstanding concern, obviously for very good reason, that political equality might be hard to have in the face of economic inequality. And there's been a growing body of literature, especially growing in American politics. It's actually, I think, been much more prominent in the other subfields of political science. But American politics is coming more and more to really documenting this lack of policy responsiveness, lack of policies that align with the interests and the preferences of low-income Americans. This is not shocking, but it is troubling from a normative perspective. And so one of the potential remedies are political parties. So theoretically, political parties serve as key linking institutions. Francis Fox Piven talks about them as agencies that actualize or fail to actualize, just to give a little hint of where I'm going, the ideal of reciprocity between voters and elites. And it's that reciprocity between voters and elites on which democracy, the idea of democracy rests. In the 50s, we knew that there was something going wrong in the one-party South in terms of representing the have-nots. And there was a call, especially by within the political science community, the American Political Science Association put out a call for responsible party government. We wanted parties that would compete with each other, that would be distinct, that would stand for things, that would not necessarily compromise, because they knew they were going to be responsible for those stances in the elections that followed. Does this sound familiar at all? There's somebody who's written a paper on responsible party government that says, you know, we didn't know what we were really asking for, because now we have the polarized parties of the United States. But it is clear that they are distinct and they are powerful. They span the whole policy process, from the nominating process, more and more evidence coming in that the parties are choosing who are the nominees well before voters are ever engaged, through elections, agenda setting, broadly, as well as agenda setting in the legislatures, policy formulation, voting, implementation, and back again. They are the thread that goes through decision making. They structure conflict, they define the agenda, they distribute power and authority. So we have these normative hopes that parties could be an avenue for people who are not organized to be represented, for people who are less likely to organize on their own to get into the policymaking process. But we also have, I think, sort of a necessity. I ask, if it's not via parties, how do we think that the preferences of low-income Americans would get incorporated in the policy process? So this is something that I was interested in. I undertook, working with Jerry Wright, who's at Indiana University, a study to look at political parties and whose and their platforms and whose interests they most reflect. Despite the great hopes for parties, there's problems with political parties if they are who we are resting the hopes of equalizing power. And this brings us to the topic of today about money and politics. U.S. elections are the most expensive in the world, expanding rapidly. Just as importantly, and tied in with that, the nature of campaigning has changed. It's not as much a matter of mobilizing and working with unions and working with cross-class organizations and associations as it is very high-cost advertising, expensive strategic consultants, media work. Policymakers are spending more and more time devoted to fundraising, and they're more and more scared about the threat of money. I talked to a member of Congress the other day who said he feels that he's walking around, at any point he could be hit by a drone attack of a super PAC that's going to put a lot of money into somebody else at any point. And he obviously wants to do something about that. This resource-dependent campaign environment, which we all know exists, makes policymakers focus on donors rather than citizens, or even, the question of residents and workers in America is a whole additional issue. And donors are not normal people. Donors are wealthy. They are super wealthy, but even within about 90% of the money that funds federal campaigns comes from people in the top 10%, much more skewed if you look at the top 1%. But they're also more ideologically driven. They're what some call high policy demanders. They don't want patronage. They're not looking for a government job. And they don't want constituent services. This isn't about having somebody to call if their pothole is, you know, there's a pothole in front of their house. They want certain policy changes. They want a country to move in the direction their ideological preferences. And they are going to hold the people they give money to accountable. Those same people are going to have to literally call them again in between 1 to 5 years, depending on the race, and they're going to know if they backed away from what they promised them or not. Very often, these, especially high donors, are interested in one or two or three issues. So a policymaker is dealing with a set of people they must rely on who each have very particular interests. The other thing that's important is, even compared to other wealthy people, people who donate to campaigns at all, not just the people who make huge donations, they have different policy views. So they are more conservative on economic issues than are even other wealthy people, and much more conservative on economic issues than is the average American. But they're more liberal on social issues than are other wealthy people, and than are other wealthy than are the average American. not to mention a poor American. So if we could equalize this distribution, we would likely have policy that would be more progressive in terms of economic policy and more restrictive in terms of social policy. And by social policy, I mean moral policy. Abortion, guns, gay rights. So they aren't good proxies for you and me, and especially for the poor. And then there's the issue of income inequality, which has expanded greatly and makes this whole problem bigger. So there's already a resource dependence, and then when there's greater income inequality, by definition, the money that you could tap is in fewer and fewer hands. You're reliant on those people. In addition, there's been some recent emerging research that is still kind of coming together, but that has pretty much convinced me that in places with more income inequality, there's also a smaller and a wealthier electorate. So it seems that in places with more income inequality, the average person and the average rich person, just or at least upper middle class, not to mention poor, are less engaged in politics, less likely to turn out. It's only, and here I'm talking about the top third. I mean, this is nothing, top third or top fifth, nothing like the oligarchs. But it's only that top third that's getting engaged, and it's only the top 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 or 5% that is getting incredibly mobilized in these contexts of income inequality. So you have a smaller and a wealthier electorate, you have a smaller set of individuals you can go to, and those people have very particular policy preferences, some of which as a policymaker, you're never going to please them. So you have to kind of shop around. So politicians are involved in a strategic search for money that and they take that money from people who want certain policies. And then that drives what they do. The other thing I wanted to mention is this is a particular problem for Democrats. So if you have a really resource-dependent campaign environment, the party with the poorer people in it isn't going to do as well, naturally. They, again, have even fewer people to draw from. So Republican Party can primarily depend on wealthy people for money, and then kind of broaden their appeals to the middle class when they want more votes. They are going to do that more often on social policy issues, because social policy issues are those in which the middle class is more conservative, as are the Republican policymakers typically, than are the wealthy. So Republicans have this tool of using social policy issues where they actually can move more conservative and broaden their electorate, and they have a natural base. I'm not saying they're not working very, very hard to raise money, but they have an inherent natural advantage. In contrast, the Democratic Party is here with this long history of a more sort of progressive, they're more left, at least, that they're dealing with. They have to appeal to wealthy, who are more likely to be conservative, so they have to appeal to the very liberal, rich people who are, they're not just shifting their agenda a little, they have to do some jumping over in terms of issues, and are really required to make specific issue appeals. And we see this most often on social issues, because they will make appeals to the very wealthy on social issues that will bring in a lot of votes and money, such as, consistent with the story, would be Obama's movement towards really embrace gay marriage in the middle of his campaign. So we expect the parties to undertake this kind of strategic, issue-based behavior.
That's Elizabeth Rigby, professor of public policy and public administration at George Washington University. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. If you're just joining us, we're examining the relationship between money and political power from the perspectives of different political science scholars. Although most states place limits on contributions to candidates from various sources, including contributions to political parties and political action committees, or PACs, Utah is one of just 4 states that does not limit donations at all. However, this past year, state lawmakers passed legislation requiring greater transparency from political donors. The impetus for transparency came from investigations of Utah's former Attorney General John Swallow that alleged Swallow's campaign used a complex system of PACs and nonprofits designed to launder campaign contributions, or so-called dark money, and hide his donors from public scrutiny. This past January, the Hinckley Institute hosted a debate between Republican Representative Greg Hughes, who sponsored the legislation to require disclosure of donors who give more than $750 to political candidates in Utah, and Bill Maurer, who is executive director of the libertarian law firm Institute for Justice. Maurer argues the new Utah law is unconstitutional and that wealthy donors should have rights to anonymity. This is both of them answering a question from the audience.
My name's Tanner East. I'm pre-dental here. Bill, my question is, like, I understand the issues that we have with the low spending limits, with the out-of-state people donating, we have opting out and all that. What could we do to help regulate things so we don't have people like the Koch brothers buying political parties? What can we do to keep people with those higher agendas, with billions of dollars, from funding all of this and stopping this?
I guess I would...
You as well.
I guess my response to that is, why would you want to stop it? The First Amendment applies to the Koch brothers as well as to anybody else in this room. And it's not the government's role, or it's not the proper role of the government, to decide who's speaking too much and who's speaking too little. And it turned on the voices of the people that it believes are unduly influencing political speech, and turn up the voices of those who are not speaking sufficiently loud enough. Because if you give the government the ability to determine who's being too influential, oftentimes the government will simply decide that the people who are being too influential, who are being unduly influential, are the people who are opposing the government. And I think it's a very, very dangerous idea that we have to stop people from engaging in politics because we're concerned that they may be too influential, that people may listen to them too much. And that was one of the concerns I had with Representative Hughes' presentation, was that he had all these arrows and charts and things all leading to a bunch of political ads. That's political speech. Political speech is what the First Amendment is all about. The idea that at the end of the day, a bunch of payday lenders spent some money and ended up talking about health care meant that people got to hear a message about health care, that voters got to hear information about health care. The fact that it may have been insincere doesn't change the fact that it's political speech. If you have the government start saying, "We believe you don't believe that particular position enough to be able to speak about it, and we have to take steps to ensure that we drill down to find out what you're really about," that's an enormous amount of intrusion of the government into people's into the ability of people to communicate freely about issues and political candidates that they may care very deeply about. So I have to reject the premise of your question and say that when it comes to the First Amendment, the founders might have written the more the merrier with regard to political speech.
My comment to that is, you mentioned the Koch brothers. Who's the casino owner?
Sheldon Adelson.
We know their names. We know who they are. I don't have a problem with them participating in this process to whatever amount their conscience dictates. I agree with that. I don't want to limit it. What I want to know is who they are. I think that's relevant to the conversation. What if we didn't know? What if super PACs didn't require full disclosure? I mean, one of the things, and it was talked about in the overview you'll read, is that in Citizens United, they say there needs to be a substantial relation to a sufficiently important government interest. Part of that government interest, the Supreme Court said, the public has an interest in knowing who is speaking about a candidate shortly before an election. Because the informational interest alone is sufficient to justify application, it is not necessary for the government to consider other interests. We know what the Supreme Court said in Citizens United. You need to know who that person is. If what was just described, if the payday lenders want to talk about health care, let them talk. But let's know that it's the payday lenders and $450,000 in that race or in two different races talking about health care. And let an informed voter or someone who may feel like they're being falsely accused or misrepresented be able to explain on their behalf what they think the context is of the attacks that they're, or the criticisms that they're receiving. Because if you don't know that the Koch brothers are out there, if you don't know that Adelson's spending his money, if you don't know who's putting these dollars to make these charges or to influence these elections, and you have these beautiful flowery names of who these people are, but at the end of the day you don't know who they are really, I think it undermines this process. And then my question becomes, why don't I just fund all races that way? Why, if there's a cost-benefit analysis that says that disclosure is prohibitive, why would a PAC ever do this another day? Why not funnel, get all the money in an anonymous way where no one has to worry about Adelson within the Jewish community has received incredible criticism for his political participation. National news. I don't know. I didn't know the guy's name before his participation. I didn't know he was Jewish and that his community was upset with him until the disclosures came out. That is a downside, and I agree to that. But if you're going to have two different tracks here in influencing campaigns, I don't know who would ever go through the cost-benefit analysis of disclosure and go through the transparent process we have if you can do it anonymously, or worse than anonymously, you can put fake names or different names to who you are. And so, again, it's got to be a level playing field. I want, as an American citizen, the same constitutional protections afforded to me in my race, in my attempts to communicate a position, as a nonprofit would have. So I just want the playing field to be level. I don't want to keep anybody out of that process.
If I may respond briefly to that before the next question. One of the things that I think is concerning and has not been adequately addressed with regard to disclosure is, do people actually receive, Representative Hughes has repeatedly said, you know, I get to know that, eyes wide open. The information that people take from disclosure may not be of any use to them, and they may actually make decisions that are wrong, or unless informed, because they have disclosure. For instance, if I lived in Representative Hughes' district and I had money to burn, I would probably donate to his campaign because I really like his position on school choice. But I'm disclosed on the lieutenant governor's website as having given the max to, or given a large amount of money to Representative Hughes. Headline, Representative Hughes supported by dark money
advocate.
And the exact opposite is true. And so we're not, you know, it's a question of not only are you going to provide people with information, but is the information in a context and in a form that they're actually going to be able to use? And what we have right now is simply not worth the trouble that it causes, because it does not create a context, does not provide sufficient information what you have. There's lots of cues that people may find particularly interesting with regard to a donor. How about the donor's race, their sex, their sexual orientation? That's all stuff people may want to know about a political donor. Why doesn't the government require that? Why does it have to know their address and their employer? Those would make that information actually would allow people to make more informed decisions. And so there is a line people draw with regard to disclosure. It cannot be, if you participate in politics, you're essentially a private version of Kim Kardashian, and everybody knows exactly what you're doing all the time for every reason. Sorry.
Thank you. I'm Howard Stevenson, state senator, senator for Greg Hughes, actually, and he's my representative. And I'm also president of the Utah Taxpayers Association, hosting this event along with the Hinckley Institute. I recall from my reading of history that the early elections in this nation were riddled with liquor and meals for voters to come in from their farms and to come and vote. And in one election, I believe it was somewhere in the terms of gallons per voter of liquor that was provided by the candidates. And one candidate, I'm trying to remember, was it Alexander Hamilton? I don't remember who it was. Refused to provide liquor and meals and lost the election and learned his lesson. In the next election, he did provide liquor. And that has led to why In this state and others, the liquor stores were required to be closed on election day. But I say that to point out that elections have always been riddled with questionable kinds of motives. But it seems to me that the real problem here that we're trying to address, Representative Hughes and the Utah legislature through House Bill 43, and also you in IJ, through your defense of the First Amendment, both sides seem to think that we need to either fix the apathy and the ignorance of the voters by informing them more on Representative Hughes' side, or counting on them to plunge the depths by electing people who were funded from anonymous sources with nefarious motives and just suffer the consequences of the bad government which we would expect to follow from that, and then learn from it and fix it in succeeding elections. So I think we're struggling to try to fix the apathy and ignorance of voters, because it is rampant in this nation, I believe. I think you would both agree with that. Mm-hmm. And it seems that that's the real problem here. IJ seems to think that we should just suffer the consequences of letting anonymous people influence elections in these ways, and ultimately the people will get mad enough that they will become less apathetic and learn from it. So, any observations about?
Yeah, Senator, let me point out that's what our pre-dental student asked us. What I think the question was is, and why I'm looking forward to this discussion is, how do you weigh these constitutional protections in an appropriate way? We all are entitled to them. And I understand some of the backlash when people step forward and get involved in political speech. How do you weigh that right to be involved with a process that isn't undermined or harmed in its outcome because you have different people playing by different rules? Every time you describe the barriers to and the consequences of disclosure, in my mind, I just keep thinking, but most of what we understand about the political process is working within that construct. And so if it's that bad, the real effort ought to be an even you know, a swath across and say that no one at any point ought to. But if you have it, and if you have those requirements, it's hard for me to argue that one should have a different set. So I would love to know what the answer to that is. How do you balance those constitutional protections with a process that you know who you're listening to, you have the relevant information? It is very difficult, and I will tell you from personal experience as a candidate, to have someone running against you and have people leveling charges at you that isn't the person who's looking to defeat you, and you can't confront them, and you can't talk about who they are. And the person who you're actually running against has no touch, has no involvement in the attacks that are going on. And let me tell you something. We, as a populace, have healthy dose of skepticism about government. We should. We should be questioning it all, okay? When you tap into people's instincts about this healthy dose of skepticism, it's very easy for people to believe the politician's a crook. They're on the take. They're doing something wrong. There is something that you can tap into, and if you can't stand by it, if you can't say who you are and why you're saying that's the case, then I think you're manipulating a public that has a watchful eye on government, and you're using that instinct because you can never get to it. You can't get in front of them. And that's something we got to improve. And I'm open to how to do that in a way that protects our constitutional liberties.
Well, ultimately, I think the problem here, ultimately what we're discussing here, I think, is a symptom instead of a disease. And I think that actually Representative Hughes may agree with me exactly what the disease is. The problem is not that we have anonymous people attempting to influence the outcome of elections or policy in order to provide benefits to themselves or burdens to others or to their opponents. The problem is we have a government that provides benefits to people and burdens to people in general. If we had a limited set of government, we had a limited government that did not have the ability to award benefits to politically influential people, or burdens to people who have angered those in politics, a lot of this would become a moot issue. Unfortunately, what we have now is a government that has metastasized far beyond its constitutional reach and has gotten in the business of deciding who's going to win and who's going to lose in politics, in the economy, in any number of realms. And that was not our constitutional structure as it was initially envisioned. And I think it's one of the reasons why we struggle with these issues is because ultimately campaign finance reform is an attempt to turn to keep a massive government from becoming little more than an oligarchy or a corrupt banana republic type of government, where the government's simply handing out favors and burdens based on who it does and does not like.
That's Bill Maurer, executive director of the libertarian law firm Institute for Justice, and Republican State Representative Greg Hughes during a debate about political donations and transparency this past January. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today, we're featuring various perspectives on money and politics and the relationship between unchecked political donations to candidates and economic and social inequality. Our last speaker is Jeffrey Winters, a professor at Northwestern University. Winters is a scholar of comparative politics, and he specializes on oligarchs and elites, spanning a range of historical and contemporary cases. He spoke at the Hinckley Institute at the University of Utah on March 20th, 2013.
Democracy is predicated on an historically quite radical notion of political equality enshrined in the institution of universal suffrage and formalized in the practice of one person, one vote. I cannot emphasize how recent in human history the institutionalization of this equality is, and that's what is particularly radical about it. So we generally accept fairly widely the notion today that participation in the political process and in our social formation more broadly should not be exclusive, first of all, and we should not weight people's vote or voice on the basis of race, tribe, property, gender, or, as the Brits used to do, giving several votes to Oxbridge Dons, because the idea was supposedly they were smart, and we want smart people voting more than people who are presumably not smart. So the idea is everybody gets one vote, and everybody presumably is supposed to be able to participate equally. These ideas are very strongly rooted in our political culture. And the question then becomes, how do you have democratic arrangements that are meaningful on the one hand, while you have stratification in society, which is not even just a bit of stratification, but actually extreme stratification? And that stratification happens also, and this is the key part, to be politically empowering. So it happens, as everybody I think is aware, built into U.S. law and institutions is not only the right to unlimited concentrations of wealth, but also the fundamental and unlimited right to use wealth to amplify speech and voice. And the most recent situation in which we saw this is Citizens United, the idea that it is unconstitutional to take someone who has tremendous power resources, and in this case, money, and use that money to amplify one's voice politically. And if you don't have money, you have a muted voice. You can still go to the polls on voting day. You can still assemble and agitate, and you can do all kinds of things, but you can't amplify your voice through just being ultra wealthy. And so, in sum, concentrated wealth, which we allow to great extreme in the system, is also concentrated power, juxtaposed to a system of radical equality. And we saw in the most recent election, but we can actually trace it throughout U.S. politics, how this plays out. In fact, in the very formation of the United States, at the Constitutional Convention, the United States had already been operating for 6 or 7 years after the last shots were fired at Yorktown under a different constitution, the Articles of Confederation. And we have to ask the question, why did people assemble at the Constitutional Convention to, by the way, their intent was to rewrite the Articles of Confederation. They ended up producing an entirely new constitution. And one of the things that obsessed people like Madison and others, all of whom today are in the, if we were to convert their wealth in today's terms, were at the level of sort of 100 millionaires, was sort of what they were worth. What was really bothering them the most? Well, there were a lot of things. Interstate commerce was a bit messy. The idea of different states having foreign policy, that wasn't good. We wanted to unite to be able to face other countries. But what was really, really alarming them was the fact that democracy was hyper-performing at the state level. That is, poor people who were indebted were taking over legislatures, and they were passing laws and issuing state-level money and script, and they were using that to repay borrowing from very wealthy creditors that they had borrowed in silver and gold. And so you saw in Madison, in the Federalist Papers, you saw the wicked problem of the production of script, right? And one of the things that the new Constitution specifically does not allow states to do is to issue money and to issue any kind of script. And so the rest of the Constitution is about what the limits on the federal government, but one of the specific limits on the states was this. In other words, one of the fundamental threats that oligarchs face, and this is where oligarchy meets democracy, right? The incredible concentrated power of wealth, when it comes in contact with democracy, the fear always was historically that if you turn over an armed state, first of all, if you disarm oligarchs, and throughout most of history, the most wealthy people throughout history have also simultaneously been armed, and they have ruled. And one of the reasons they had to do this was because concentrated wealth is not an equilibrium outcome socially. So there are all kinds of threats that come to concentrated wealth. The first thing we think of is a threat from below. Those who don't have anything tend to attack those who have a lot of money and a lot of property and a lot of wealth. But actually, throughout history, one of the biggest sources of threat to oligarchs was other oligarchs. And so all the castles and fortifications and militias that knights and lords and others had were mainly to protect not against, you know, pitchforks and so on coming from the peasants, but actually one of the ways you got richer during that period, you didn't have a capitalist accumulation system, so you would take over the lands and the peasantry of other oligarchs. So it was horizontal, actually. So you had to be armed if you were rich. And one of the achievements of the modern state, as Max Weber points out to us, is the very definition that he gives, and it's a strange definition of the modern nation state, is a monopoly on the means of coercion. Meaning, everyone in the system, for the first time in history, is disarmed, including the oligarchs, and now the protection of property and fortune is done by the state. The democratic problem is this. As long as the state is in the hands of oligarchs, that's not a problem. But if the state falls into the hands of large majorities of people who might get the crazy idea of redistributing, maybe, or having tax burdens fall more heavily on those who are better able to pay, then oligarchs face a very difficult problem under democracy, which is how to live under what Aristotle called a polity. And he described a polity as being, by the way, if you read The Politics, and I recommend Aristotle's work to you because it's fascinating. Here he is in ancient times. He's grappling with the fundamental problem. How do we come up with a political system that simultaneously has the wealthy protected and the poor not too exploited so that neither one rises up? This is what he's struggling with. And he says the key is to come up with a fusion so that on any given day, I could actually read the quote to you, but I'll just paraphrase it. On any given day, you don't know whether you're in an oligarchy or a democracy. And that's the perfect system. Right? And I would argue in the United States, not exactly perfect, but we are fairly close to a system in which on any given day we see that democratic engagement and participation pays off, achieves victories, is important, and if you don't engage, you don't get anything. And on the other hand, we are, I think, very aware that those who have tremendous resources are able distort the system, distort the agenda, and have policies that protect their interests in ways that are all out of proportion to their numbers within a democracy. We're talking about a tiny sliver of the population being able to get some tremendous political outcomes. I'm going to close with just a couple of observations about what it is that oligarchs gain with their power. Let me give you one example. And to do this, I first of all have to talk a moment about offshoring. Okay? Offshoring, it's too complicated to talk about. But basically, the latest estimate we have is between $21 and $32 trillion exists in offshore secrecy locations around the world, of which a substantial proportion of that is American money. There are 80 secrecy locations, Cayman Islands and Bahamas and all kinds of other places. And, of course, the money doesn't actually sit there. It flows through, and it sits in London and New York and so on. But the key thing is, when you place your money offshore, you're not taxed, and governments can't follow your money. So I'm a turbo taxpayer. And almost all of you are what I call turbo taxpayers. You buy a piece of software, or you go to H&R Block on the corner, you try to get through a 1040. It reminds you, oh, did you take a deduction for the books you bought this year because you're a professional, blah, blah. That's it, okay? Then there are people who hire what I call the wealth defense industry in the United States. This is an entire industry whose sole existence is to protect and shelter the wealth of the ultra-wealthy in the United States so they don't pay taxes. And there is something called a tax opinion letter. No tax-paying mortal has ever heard of a tax opinion letter. Not one of you in the room has ever, unless you're really a wealthy family to which you've heard of it. All right. I never heard of it till I researched it. A tax opinion letter is a letter produced by the wealth defense industry, specifically by lawyers who operate in the wealth defense industry, and they produce a 20-page opinion letter for you that interprets 72,000 pages of U.S. tax code so that you don't have to pay a particular tax. Okay? The tax opinion letter costs you between $1 and $3 million for the letter. You save, on average, between $30 and $300 million in any given tax year. It is going to structure a transaction for you in some foreign secrecy jurisdiction. The U.S. Senate is aware of this. In fact, they even have a number. How much money do American oligarchs not pay in taxes annually by virtue of these tax products, they're called, and placing money just offshore? I'm not talking about corporations, individuals. $70 billion a year by a very small number of people is not paid in taxes. That's a U.S. Senate number, not some crazy professor's number. Okay? Second, last example I'll give you. I know it's mind-numbing to talk about taxes. It's boring, but believe me, taxes tell you a lot about power throughout history. Who gets taxed? Who doesn't get taxed? Who gets to push taxes onto others? The second one is this. If you compare 1958 to 2010, there are six tax brackets in 2010 or 2012 today. The highest tax bracket is 35%. In 1958, there were 19 tax brackets above the 35% level. It looked like a staircase of tax brackets going up. The highest one was 91%, okay, in 1958. Now, oligarchs, through the wealth defense industry and through their political lobbying and the expression of their power, have eliminated the entire staircase of 19 tax brackets from going all the way up to 95. They have eliminated 56% in tax brackets, and they now pay the same tax as someone who made, in 1958, $200,000. So it doesn't matter if you make $200 million or $4 billion in income, you pay the same tax bracket as someone who makes $200,000. That is a political victory, ladies and gentlemen. Another side of the political victory to all of this is they're basically the number one thing that oligarchs are upset about in the 20th century is the rise of the welfare state, which comes out of the populist movement and it comes out of the Great Depression. And this vast cushion for the poor was put in place. And politically, they don't have the numbers and they don't have the strength to be able to eliminate the welfare state entirely. So what you do is you squeeze it. You squeeze it so you say, we're broke. Okay? We're broke, and therefore we can't afford bridges, school teachers, expenditures on poor people to make sure that we have a society that's sane and livable. We can't afford that. Actually, we can afford it. How much money is saved by the same, you know the group I said a moment ago who saved $70 billion by offshoring? That same group by eliminating the 19 levels of tax brackets. If that same tax system were in place today, they would pay $100 billion more in taxes. We are now at $170 billion a year, more than we paid for both wars on an annual basis. That we were just recently engaged in. Those are the political outcomes under a democracy. It's how a small group of people get tremendous gains, apply tremendous pressure on U.S. citizens, and how you have a partial democracy, but you also have a partial oligarchy.
Unfortunately, because of time, we're going to have to end things there. That's Jeffrey Winters, a professor of political science at Northwestern University. You've been listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. This program was brought to you by the Hinckley Institute of Politics and the Department of Political Science at the University of Utah. You can hear this program again and other podcasts on KCPW's website, and you can follow this program on Twitter at @KCPWHinckley. Join us every Wednesday morning at 10 a.m. to hear more engaging forums and speakers on political and legal issues affecting Utah. I'm Ross Chambliss, and this is KCPW. Yeah.